Blog Talk Radio.
United, our midweek edition. Welcome to the show tonight. Got a great one tonight. Actor Michael Chiklis, you know him from The Shield and Fantastic Four and a lot of other great projects. He's got a new movie out. It opens June 1st. That's this Friday. It's a comedy called High School. He'll be coming on and talk a little bit about that and some other things.
Oh, cool.
But first, guys, let's talk a little movie news, movies that we've seen in the past couple of days. Because I've seen a couple of movies.
Okay, you know, I had seen
Wow,
couple.
That's different.
I love to start the show off with some condescension. That's great. What, Jerry, did you say, were you about to say that you saw something?
You know, I had seen a whole bunch of things before we went on Sunday, but we never got to talk about that because we're talking about war movies. So,
did Moonrise Kingdom come near you?
Yet? No, that's this weekend. Hopefully we'll get to see that this weekend. I hope. You know, because we also have Piranha 3, what is it, 3DD? Or
3DD. That's the funniest
Wait, is
title
that Dean
of the
in the
year.
Background?
Yes, that's me.
I was wondering who the... Sounds like he's in someone's house this time. Is it you, Jamie?
I'm in my house.
Really?
Yes.
It sounds so crystal clear. It doesn't sound like you're calling from the inside of a
submarine. Oh, yeah. Dean sounds crystal clear, all right.
I think it has something to do with how I hold the phone. I think that's the way.
That has to be it.
Anyway, yeah.
Anyway, did you see the Hemingway, the HBO thing?
Yeah, I saw that.
That's gotten some really negative reviews.
It's not, it's, I have, my thing is, like, I think there's some really, thank God it wasn't released in theaters, because I think I would have fallen asleep. But I think my main problem with it is, like, it's just, they don't know what to do with, I think it could have been edited somewhat, because I think there are parts that just, like, drag on. I also think there's some very interesting parts, too. I do think there's a really interesting story in there.
Yeah.
But it just gets, I don't know about you guys, I just thought it meandered at times.
I did, too.
Well,
I mean,
I
like Philip Kaufman,
mm-hmm.
And I like everyone involved.
Right.
It was an odd thing. I mean, I enjoyed it. At the same time, I thought it was more or less a failed project.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
But I got enjoyment out of it. I got enjoyment out of watching the two of them.
Right.
First of all, stylistically, I didn't like the constant newsreel overlay effect that they did.
Yeah.
That's been a constant criticism of the movie, is the cutting to the grainy black and white footage.
And there are moments in there when there's absolutely no reason for it.
I agree with you.
Nicole Kidman, I thought, was great. I thought that was a really kind of balls out performance from her.
Mm-hmm.
If it's possible for Nicole Kidman to have her balls out,
no.
I mean, that's
now who plays the male lead in it?
Clive Owen.
Clive Owen. Okay.
I have a horrible thing. I thought the guy who played Hemingway in Midnight in Paris was far superior.
Yeah.
I don't mean that in a bad way. I just thought he was a much more interesting take on the Hemingway character. And I realize that's a younger Hemingway. That's a different. That's a Hemingway in a different period. But I don't know. There's just there's just something missing in this. There was no great, like, divine spark, I guess you would say. Like, they hold it all together. I agree with you. I think stylistically, and it's, you know, it's good to see Philip. This is like the first Philip Kaufman film since what, Twisted? And,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's been a lot. It's been like 8 years since he's had a movie. So it's always good to see him with a movie. But I just didn't work for me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not going to bring a lot of people to who don't know about Philip Kaufman to Philip Kaufman movies.
I don't know. That's an interesting point, Dean. I don't know. It did make me want to seek out. There's a movie, based on a Hemingway book with George C. Scott, Islands in the Stream or something.
Islands in the Stream.
My
yes.
mom was telling me that was something that my brothers had seen when they were very young, and that had a big effect on them. So I want to check that out at some point.
It's kind of like
that. Really good.
I've seen that. That's a little tepid. That's a little dry. I don't think that movie. I don't think they've made a really great Hemingway movie. I mean, they tried to Richard Attenborough tried to do it with In Love and War a few years ago with Chris O'Donnell and Sandra Bullock.
Did James Ivory already do a Hemingway, or is he about to do a Hemingway?
I don't think he's done a Hemingway yet, and I haven't heard anything about James Ivory's next project at all. So
I think he's doing a Hemingway movie, and Anthony Hopkins is Hemingway.
That's a good choice.
That would be a very interesting choice,
like a late period Hemingway. That would be very interesting.
Yeah, obviously it's late period, and then. And then Antonio Banderas, I think, is playing Picasso.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's the same project
cool.
or not. But
yeah.
Anyway, speaking of, and it has like an out of nowhere supporting, like one scene supporting performance from Robert Duvall in it.
Yeah.
Which I heard
it's a good
was
scene.
Kind of embarrassing. I heard was sort of embarrassing.
Oh, no, I think
yeah.
it's a fine scene. I think it's fine.
Yeah.
There's no reason whatsoever for Robert Duvall to be doing it, except that he likes Philip Kaufman. But
yeah.
Anyway, Philip Kaufman, you know, I love Invasion of the Body Snatchers. That was 78. Donald Sutherland.
But, I mean, he's done some, I mean post that, I mean, that's a great remake, no question about it. But, I mean, you think about... I mean, obviously The Right Stuff, which is one of the great,
right.
one of the greatest movies about America ever.
Henry and June,
and then his best movie, which is Unbearable Lightness mm-hmm. of Being, I think is I mean superb. He's a great filmmaker and a great didn't he co-write Raiders of the Lost Ark?
I think you're right.
He's one of the co-writers of Raiders of the Lost Ark and also of Outlaw Josie Wales.
Well, I mean, I like him very much, and there's actually a new book that's been written about his movies, which is interesting. It's a good topic to explore, but there's a reason why I brought up Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I was working on a segue, because I thought when this one movie I saw this weekend, I kept thinking of Donald Sutherland and Invasion of the Body Snatchers and how kind of subtle he was in that movie
mm-hmm.
in comparison to Bertolucci's 1900, which I sat through this weekend.
That doesn't sound like you liked it. You sat through it.
Well, I mean, it's a five-hour movie. it's his uncut, you know, vision of the film, and man, it's a mess. Sometimes it's a glorious mess, but most of the time it's just puzzling. There's no focus in it, and the performances are awfully lampoony. I mean, when Gerard Depardieu is the most subtle thing in your movie,
boy, really.
And this is long before he urinates in the airplane. I mean, so.
Yes. But Donald Sutherland in this movie plays the bad guy to end all bad guys.
Yes,
he is out there, and he does things in this movie that I never thought I'd see depicted in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
He was shocking. He's not happy with the movie. He never has been happy with it. But,
That's a difficult film. I mean, you know, that's a movie you got to respect the effort that went into it. But the effort that goes into watching it is sometimes seems greater.
Yeah. You know? Well, De Niro, Burt Lancaster, Donald Sutherland, Gerard Depardieu. It's got a top flight cast, and Bertolucci was coming off of The Last Tango in Paris, and he felt empowered that he could do whatever he wanted.
Yeah, on paper it looks great, but on film, it's
great. Ennio Morricone score, though, and great visuals.
Yeah.
Vittorio Storaro. Mm-hmm. You know, Richardson talked about the pairing of Storaro and Bertolucci when we talked to him, and said that that's the pinnacle for him. And I mean,
Storaro is the hero of that movie. Actually, I think his efforts are what keep you going through it. I think,
I think so too. But I mean, you think of Bertolucci's movies and in general, and the contribution that Storaro made. You know, from Last Tango to The Last Emperor.
Yeah,
you know,
and The Sheltering Sky. Don't forget The Sheltering Sky.
No, that's a good one. It's a good one too.
Yeah, they made many movies together. Actually, he took a break from Bertolucci to shoot Apocalypse Now.
And also
Reds. Don't forget Reds. I mean, I think Reds is his master. Is Storaro's masterpiece. Mm-hmm. I think. You know.
Mm.
I mean, Reds, I mean, just when you're looking at Warren Beatty's Reds, and you just see those first scenes of just the witnesses talking about the real life people who really knew John Reed, who's the subject of the movie. They're just photographed against a black background, and man, I tell you, that has had such an effect on movies and television, and the way people photograph, filmmakers photograph interview subjects. I think.
Yeah.
It's that technique has been repeated quite a bit. So.
Well, I've been interested in Bertolucci lately. Bertolucci had a new movie that premiered at Cannes this year, and it's a smaller format kind of movie, a more intimate story than he normally tells, and Cronenberg raved about it. He said he loved it when he saw it. It's one of the few movies that Cronenberg got to see at Cannes. But and then I was looking back through some of his movies that I knew nothing about. There's a movie called Luna. It was made right after 1900.
That's a very unusual movie. That's with
Joe Clayburgh.
Joe Clayburgh as a opera singer who has a relationship with her son. Has a sexual relationship with her son. That's probably why you can't see that movie. I mean, there's no sign of that movie.
Right. Isabelle Huppert would take. I mean,
doesn't that
sound like at a time or part that she would have taken? I mean,
Maybe it's time for Michael Haneke to remake Luna.
I can't disagree with that statement.
The masses are clamoring for a remake of Luna. So there's one piece of business that I was remiss not to cover from Cannes on our last show.
Oh God.
And this might bring up a little bit of a defense on my part. One of the movies that showed at Cannes is the movie that we're tied to, which is Room 237.
That
showed there? Wow.
Yeah, which is the IFC has it, and they're going to release it this summer, so they wanted to premiere it on an international format. So that's the documentary from Rodney Asher and Tim Kirk that explores all the various theories involved in The Shining, which we covered a little bit. Generous chunk of our Shining show was about this. Yeah, I mean, 40 minutes of our 2-hour and 40-minute show on The Shining was dedicated to the theories. So it didn't dominate that show by any means, but I mean, it was a sizable chunk. Anyway, so they've been interviewed, they were interviewed by Movie City News, and Movie City News, David Poland there, I like his interviews, I like how he does
them. I love David Poland, yeah.
he interviewed them on the beach, and he came out with a little sneak preview of it, of some of his video clips from Cannes. And here's this a bit of the sneak preview from when he interviewed the directors, the director of Room 237 and the producer.
Our investigation into the hidden meanings of The Shining was in some way creating more investigation by other folks. And there was like this podcast team that was doing a series of Kubrick documentaries, and they were kind of chasing some of the people that we were chasing at the same time, so it felt like kind of a race. And one person that we talked to would tell us about another, and then they had a friend who was just about to post something.
Yeah.
So there was something in the air. There's almost like a fever pitch race for everybody to get what they were thinking about The Shining out of them 30-some years later, 2011, 2012.
Okay.
You didn't mention the podcast name, though.
No. But, I mean, I maybe it's just because it's a good soundbite. I didn't feel like I was in a race with him at all or in competition with him at all.
Right. I mean, he probably felt that because, let's face it, I mean, you know, there's a lot more work that goes into making a movie than it is making a podcast. And I know that you work very hard on your podcast, and I don't mean to denigrate that at all. But it's like, you know, I mean, so much money goes into making a movie that it's like. You know, that's probably how he felt. You know, that's all I'm saying. You know.
Well, I feel the same way. I mean, we're two completely different projects. And his sole intention was to explore the theories. So here's how it worked. In 2010, I interviewed Bill Blakemore because I wanted the theories to be a part of it, and Bill Blakemore was the first theorist that I interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Blakemore told me during the interview, hey, I've just been contacted by these documentary filmmakers. Do you want me to put... who are making a movie about this very stuff. Do you want me to put you in contact with them? I said, sure. So we got in contact with them. Jerry and I got on the phone with them.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, as the months and the year went on, I mean, we've been in contact back and forth for ever since. We were like, hey, how's it going? How's it going? Blah, blah, blah. And they asked me, do you have Jeffrey Cox's contact information? And I said, sure, because they said we might want to put him in the film, which they did.
Mm-hmm.
Jeffrey Cox is one of five people in the film. And I think that's why I'm in the credits, because I gave them I helped them out with the contact for Jeffrey Cox. So how would that, I mean, why would it be a competition if I'm helping them?
Right.
First of all.
Well, you got to look at it, that's what I'm saying. You got to look at it from where they're standing. They've sunk a lot of money into it. They it's possible that they might have started the project before you started the podcast and the idea of just doing the Shining podcast, and you got to look at it from their standpoint and everything. That said, they should have mentioned the podcast name. You know what I'm saying? They should have done that out of kindness or whatever. But I don't want to create a fight or anything. But whatever.
Well, I've tried to look at it from their point of view, but our goals were completely different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean. If they want to get mad at somebody, get mad at the thousands of web pages that explore the different theories, which form the basis of their movie to begin with.
Right, right.
Well, that's true. That's true. And by the way, they've been people. I mean, back when The Shining came out in 1980, I remember reading an issue of maybe Film Comment or maybe Film Quarterly or whatever, and that's where I first got. I think it was Film Quarterly actually that first gave me opened my eyes to the notion that the film was about the desecration of the Indians that America had run roughshod over the Indians and had built over their burial grounds, and that's what was the cause of the hauntings there and stuff, you know. I mean, you know, but everybody should just take, you know, take heart you know, there shouldn't be any kind of competition. It should be just everybody taking heart in the fact.
Well, I never felt that way.
And
I kept writing them and telling them, I'm so proud of you guys. I'm so excited to see the movie.
Right.
And I genuinely am, and I definitely want to have them back on when it comes out this summer, I think next month or in June. We're getting close to it. But because I want to see the thing. But he would write me, and he'd kind of, I mean, he was unfailingly polite, but he, at the same time, it sounded like he was trying to suggest that I was some kind of nemesis of the project. I said, look, my podcast can't possibly do what your movie is going to do, and nor was it supposed to.
Right.
I mean, nor did I aim to have it do that. It takes up 30% of our show. It's about the making of it. It's about Kubrick more than the different meanings and everything. That being said, everyone that listened to it tended to gravitate towards the different theories because that's the most kind of delicious part of it, you know. But
well, we should maybe just take a chance.
Cut it out,
man. We should maybe just take a chance at maybe thinking that it's actually a compliment, you know. I mean, that they thought that, you know, they were in competition with us, you know, because, you know, yes, this is a little podcast or whatever, you know, but they actually held it in such high esteem that they actually thought that they were in competition with us. So
I mean, we've communicated several times throughout the year. I mean, every month. I mean, several times a month throughout the entire year. I mean, so we're regularly in contact back and forth.
Well, I'm sure it's okay, you know. I'm sure when you talk to them again, and I'm sure they'll be happy to talk to you again, and I'm sure it's fine.
I guess what it comes down to is the reason why I was hurt by it, I mean, not upset as in angry, but hurt by it, is because there's so many jerks that think they're more than they are.
Right.
And, you know, that do this kind of thing. And I'm deathly afraid of being looked upon as one of those jerks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but at the same time, I want to be proud of my accomplishments
without
them. But I don't want to denigrate anyone else's, you know, or feel like I'm not in competition. I mean, I do feel competitive with the show, but not against people that are good at it. I mean, if somebody's good at doing this kind of thing, I say, well, that's great. I'm
mm-hmm.
officially a fan of yours.
And you're always very supportive of other podcasts, too. I mean,
yes, you are.
Well, all of us are, really, you know. So it's just like, it will make for a very interesting conversation when you do have them back on the show.
I guess I'd be remiss not to touch upon this when we talk
about
it.
Well, you have to, because you have to.
I've opened Pandora's box,
No, you have to. Right. Yes.
Let's play our first interview, and then I want to talk about a couple other things, including a great trailer that got released today. Ooh. But first,
okay.
Michael Chiklis, great actor. He's been in a lot of great stuff. And I think most people probably know him from The Shield more than anything nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
Did he win a couple of Emmys for that? At least one Emmy for that, right?
Yeah, I'm sure he did. I'll have to look that up, but thank you for issuing that challenge.
maybe a Golden Globe, you know.
Yeah. I don't think he won an Oscar for it, though. But The Shield is such an indelible character.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, he did The Commish. So, I mean, he made a mark in The Commish as well.
Right.
I remember that show. I remember watching that show
the
first run. But the Fantastic Four series, which was huge for him, he started his career. His first role in a feature film was John Belushi in Wired.
Yeah.
And that kind of came across as a catastrophic project that was
mm-hmm.
very compromised.
And he's still famous for that, I mean, in some ways. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, he addresses that in this interview. But he also talks about his brand new movie that opens June 1st. It's a comedy. It's called High School. It co-stars Colin Hanks. And it's good to see him in a comedy again.
Right.
After, you know, the brute the bruteness of the Shield and that kind of thing, and playing the Thing. You know, it's like,
yeah,
it's a welcome return, and he's hysterical in this movie. It's actually a very good movie, and if this catches on, it could be a major kind of young person's movement around this film, like a Fast Times kind of thing.
Oh, cool.
So here is Arenada Diaz, our home entertainment correspondent, put on his theatrical entertainment hat.
I love Aaron.
To interview Michael, and here, where is it? Oh, here it is. Okay.
Cool,
here it is, guys.
Where do they come up with all these clever names for recreational drug use? Roasting a bone, banging down a stiff Lucy.
Hey, Mom, I got some MIT scholarship stuff that I filled out.
Honey, I clogged the toilet again.
The plunger should be in the, under the sink.
Where?
You know what the problem is here, Brandon?
The internet?
The sticky green.
You've never done this before, have you?
Not freedom.
It's time we expunge this school of all dope fiends. We are conducting a screening, and any student who does not pass will be expelled.
If I'm busted, I can kiss my MIT scholarship goodbye.
You're causing a scene.
I'm causing a scene.
We failed the test and no one even noticed.
How could I fail the test and no one cares?
If everyone fails, tomorrow's a bake sale. We swap in special brownies.
Where are we going to get that much weed?
I mean, you're known for playing, obviously, heavies, but people probably don't know this. You know, if they go back to your work, you've always done comedy. I mean, I remember your sitcom, Daddy-O, and...
Sure.
I mean, even your first big film, you were playing a comic icon, and then there was the Three Stooges movie. So what was it like finally getting back into that comedy mode?
Well, that's why I jumped at it, because it was an opportunity to play, you know, a character that I could completely disappear and, you know, and do a comedic turn. And, I just wasn't getting many opportunities to do comedy, let alone, you know, sort of outrageous stoner comedy. And it was just very funny on paper and really good people involved. And I just thought, you know, this could be a blast. And sure enough, it really was. It was a great time shooting this, and that's why I'm supporting the film, because, you know, it's really funny. It's good, you know, and little movies like this, you know, you got to really help them out. You got to get the word out, and I really think that this was perhaps the first ever cinematic stoner comedy in history. You know, the way John shot the movie, it just really, I don't know, have you seen it?
Yes, and yes, it does look good.
It was really well shot, you know, and it was just fun for all of us. Colin Hanks and I had a blast together. We laughed every day, blew tons of takes laughing, and, you know, that's just, you know, it was fun for me because, I've been, you know, playing a bunch of sort of dark and heavy characters in recent years, and it was just an opportunity for me to have some fun.
So is it true? So you've done both. So is it true the adage about comedy is harder than drama?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Particularly in film, because you don't have the the benefit of instant feedback with an audience. You know, with a live audience, if you're doing a comedy, you know night to night, you can, you know, see where the laughs lay, and you know, and you can get your timing honed in, but you know, with a comedic film, it's instinct. A lot of it is instinct and just believing in the funny of it and just committing to it 100%. But it's definitely much more difficult to film a comedy that really works. Right. And to their credit, I think everybody involved was really, really ultra committed and really. Committed to their characters 100%. You know, it was just a ridiculousness. We just really relished in being playing these absurd people.
And was the hair, the idea to have hair, is that in the script, or was that something you brought to it to just make
that was
it different?
Something that John and I talked about right away. Because I saw him as a clown, and I wanted him to be a redhead.
Yeah.
And John loved the idea right away and embraced it. And we just, you know, it wasn't in the script. It was something we just discussed. And, you know, we just flew with it. And it really, I think it really, really worked. And it was also an added way of me sort of disappearing in the character. And one of the thrills for me is at the Sundance Film Festival when the movie ran, you know, the vast majority of people in that audience did not know it was me, because, you know, between the way the look, the way I walked, the way I spoke, that transatlantic, you know, that mid-Atlantic sound and everything, it was, you know, a real fun character turn for me, and people didn't know it was me until the credits ran.
And let me ask, you bring up Sundance, and that's and I wanted to bring that up. I mean, talk about that Sundance experience, because if I know my history correctly, I mean, that's got to be totally different. I mean, I remember as a kid, I remember reading about how Wired went to the Cannes Film Festival, and now you're at Sundance. So, I mean, those had to be two polar opposite kind of experiences.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one was a controversial mess, and one was just a, you know, sort of a euphoric love fest and huge, great reviews for high school. And the only thing about that's been frustrating is that was 2010. You know, we've been really, you know, sort of looking at this from a distance, meaning the guys in the cast, and sort of going, what happened to high school? Why hasn't it come out yet? You know, and it's just about, you know, putting together a distribution deal that was palatable, I guess, to the financiers. I don't know exactly what the situation there was, but, you know, I was bummed because, you know, I knew we had this really funny, good movie in the can, and I'm thrilled now that it's going to get an opportunity for audiences to see it. And I just want to, it's one of those kind of films that could go viral, particularly, you know, the whole college scene when, you know, people start seeing this. It always had the earmarks of a potentially, you know, classic comedy in the vein of Fast Times at Ridgemont High or Ferris Bueller's Day Off or one of those kind of films.
And I do want to ask about Wired, because I'm actually an admirer of your performance in that film. I mean, it's obviously script wise, it's obviously very troubled and very messy.
Yeah.
But I do agree, I don't know if you remember this, but I do agree with the old, I remember when the movie got reviewed on Siskel and Ebert, and I do agree with their take in that, you know, whatever the problems with the film were, your performance and Gary Groom's performance as Dan Aykroyd were very good. And so I'm wondering, when you're in that, I mean, because obviously it was a big break for you, but also, you know, what does that look like to you now, almost 25 years later?
Well, in all honesty, that you know, we could spend a good 2 hours on this, but you know, the real abridged version is that, you know, that it was Dickensian. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was for me, because remember, it was the first time I was ever on a film set in my life. You know, all of a sudden, my first gig in film or television is playing an icon that I loved. I looked at it as an homage, and I think that Gary and I really threw ourselves at it. I was very, very green in terms of my, you know, in all honesty, I only saw the film once. You know, and it was at the Cannes Film Festival, and I was devastated because of how much of it had been cut.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently there were so many lawsuits pending against the film that they couldn't use a lot of what was really the core of the film while we were shooting it. So, I mean, I look at it as an incredible learning experience for me. I'm glad that it happened in the way that it did. It humbled me in a lot of ways. It made me really appreciate the successes that I've had subsequent to that. You know, so, geez, I don't know how to encapsulate it in a in a matter of a soundbite. You know, I just, it was a sort of an epic time in my life and very scary and tumultuous. But at the end of the day, I have no regrets, and I'm glad on a lot of levels that it happened, because I learned a lot from the process, and as many things of how not to approach a film and how to as to how to, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So yeah, it was again, I was doing off Broadway theater and waiting tables when I got that job. I was a kid, a big break. You know, heady stuff,
right.
Based on a book by, you know, the great Bob Woodward, you know, took down Nixon. It was very, like, overwhelming at the time, and all I could do was fall back on my training as an actor. You know, I went to Boston University School of Fine Art and, you know, had been an actor on the stage professionally since I was 13, so I was just completely reliant on that and just trying to do my best, you know, moment to moment as an actor. All the peripheral stuff was distracting and hard, because it was frightening, you know. My first interviews, to have people asking me if I thought I would be blackballed or if I thought I'd, you know, ever work again, was, as you can imagine, kind of terrifying.
Right.
But here it is 25 years later, or whatever, how many years it is, and
right,
everything's okay.
And my last question I'll ask you, I got to ask because I'm a huge fan of his. I understand you just worked with Taylor Hackford.
I did.
In a movie. What is that, and what was that experience like?
The short answer there is Taylor is a really he's an interesting character. He's larger than life and a really powerful presence. And
he has a hot wife.
Yes. Oh, and a phenomenally talented wife too. And it was just it was a cool experience. I'd say the only downside of the experience is that it was August and September in New Orleans, so it was beyond hot. But it was interesting. It was good.
Okay, that is Michael Chiklis. The movie is High School. It opens up this Friday. To read more about it, go to highschool-themovie.com. For the record, Michael Chiklis has won an Emmy and a Golden Globe for his work in The Shield. To answer your question, Dean.
I thought so.
I love that. I love Aaron. He's like, he's a crazy, he's very talented, and he's got a hot wife.
He's a great writer.
Yeah, I was like, I did a double take there.
I would never have the courage to say, and he's got a hot wife. But, you know, it's
Aaron is a great writer. And can I say something about Aaron's voice on the air? Aaron has such a unusual and great voice for this podcast. He's terrific.
Wow. Well, there's a lot of editing involved in that. I'm kidding. I love Aaron. He's one of my closest friends. I love him. Bless him for helping us.
Definitely. No, that
as
was
much
just,
as
I was did, had to do a double take. Though he said hot wife. I was like, Aaron, really?
I actually rewatched Wired last week.
God, I haven't seen it since it made the rounds on cable like so long ago. But
no, the whole thing's on YouTube.
Oh wow! Okay.
It is a mess, and you can see how it was, as he said, compromised probably by lawsuits in the post. Yeah.
It's a movie that I've never really like. Have you watched it, Jerry? I've never watched it because
It's a hard. Yeah. It's not an easy movie to get into. It's a weird, weird movie. I mean,
does anybody know the director? Is the director on anybody's tongue? The tip of anybody's tongue?
No, I don't know.
I'll look it up. But I mean, I will say it's absolutely not Michael Chiklis' fault or the actor that plays Dan Aykroyd. I mean, because you think of like an impossible role, and for it to be your first feature film. I mean, he does as well with it as the material allows him to.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
Larry Pierce directed it. Larry.
Larry Pierce. He's done a few other movies too.
Prior to Wired, Wired was the last movie he directed. prior to Wired, he did Hard to Hold, the Rick Springfield movie.
Right, okay. I actually know that movie. Okay, what else did he do?
The Bell Jar, The Other Side of the Mountain, Part 2.
Oh, okay.
The Bell Jar is actually not bad.
Ash Wednesday.
Ash Wednesday is an interesting movie, too.
He did The Other Side of the Mountain, the first one as well. 2 Minute Warning.
That's a fantastic movie, right?
Yeah, that's an intermittently entertaining movie. Also with John Cassavetes and tons of other people in it too. It was like a sort of a entry into the disaster film kind of thing, but it was a sniper at the Super Bowl.
Right.
Yeah.
But I mean, Wired. I mean, one of Ray Sharkey's last performances.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Who did he play in it?
Well, what's the role of the guy that guides in A Christmas Carol? The guy that guides.
Yeah, he plays. That's right. He plays like an imaginary
character. Okay. Oh boy, that's
like an angel. He plays an angel essentially.
I think that's the thing. When I read that when I read that, I said, "Oh, this sounds bad. I'm not going to watch this because it's got a guy playing."
JT Walsh is in it. JT Walsh plays Bob Woodward.
Huh.
That's another thing. They wanted to make Bob Woodward a part of the actual movie, I guess because of the All the President's Men stuff.
Right. Here's the thing with the movie. I remember when the movie came out, before the movie came out, there's a lot of things like no one would cooperate. No one from Saturday Night Live would cooperate with anyone involved with the movie, especially like Aykroyd and those sort of things. That's what I remember most about the movie.
First of all, can I interject here? I know that you had. I wanted to talk just for like 2 minutes about, or maybe even a minute, about a movie that I watched this weekend.
Okay.
It's a movie from 1987. And this is a filmmaker that we've never talked about on the show because I'm not sure that you guys have seen many movies by this filmmaker, but he's a great filmmaker who was there with Roger Corman doing and Dennis Hopper working on Easy Rider,
mm-hmm.
and that's Henry Jaglom.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. We've had Anna Frederick, who's worked with him a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Henry, I watched, I just recently bought a VHS copy because I couldn't find it on DVD. It's probably on DVD, but I bought it on VHS. I bought Someone to Love.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a film about it's really sort of a meta kind of film. It's a film about Henry Jaglom's film about him trying to make a film about loneliness. And one of the incredible things in it, I mean, it's a great movie. It's him. It's Henry Jaglom and he has his brother, played by Michael E. Mill, who you might remember, who played Albert Einstein in Insignificance, the Nicholas Rogue
mm-hmm,
movie.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and they play brothers, and Michael E. Mill is very lonely, and Henry Jaglom is just sort of having trouble with his relationship, and he decides to throw a party for his brother so he can meet some women. And they throw this party at this theater in Los Angeles that's about to be torn down, but by some coincidence, the brothers own the theater, and it's about to be torn down in 10 days. So they throw the party in the theater. And this movie is really great, but it has lots of people in it. I mean, it's got Sally Kellerman and Stephen Bishop, you know, the songwriter who
wrote
the songs from Tootsie, and it's got tons of people in it. I mean, Monty Hellman is in it. It's crazy how many people
Monty
are
Hellman's
in it.
Really? Monty Hellman's in it.
Yeah, Monty Hellman is one of the people
many.
That comes to the party.
Okay.
And it's got tons of people in it. It's a very interesting movie.
The last movie in which Orson Welles appeared as well.
That's what I was getting to. Orson Welles is so great in this movie. He comes in at about towards the end of the movie, after the party has done and everybody's pouring their hearts out about why they're lonely and what they're looking for in a relationship and everything like that, and some people could see the movie as being very touchy-feely and too touchy-feely, too L.A. touchy-feely, but... Orson Welles comes in, and man, is he great in this movie. This movie skates the fine line between, is this movie written down on paper? Is this dialogue written down on paper, or is this improvised? And it's really difficult to tell, and I love those movies where you can't tell whether the thing is improvised or whether it's written. Orson Welles is so superb in this movie, and the movie is actually dedicated to Orson Welles. He is incredible in it.
Yeah, because this was released in 87, and he passed in 85, so apparently this was...
Yeah.
Yeah. It's his last on-screen performance, and man, is it good. I would recommend...
Well, there's two ways to look at it.
It could
be his last on-screen performance or his follow-up to Transformers.
Yeah, exactly. His follow-up
to Transformers. I just bought a Henry Jekyll movie on Blu-ray.
Really? What was it?
It's part of that BBS Criterion set. It's a safe place. It's on the disc with Drive, he said.
Oh, right. Exactly. See, so he's part of it. It's funny because Henry Jekyll doesn't get as much press as he deserves because he is really part of so much of 70s movie history.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting about Jaglom is he gets so much more interesting in the 80s and the early 90s. And I Someone to Love is probably my favorite of his movies, but his best movie was probably done in the 90s. It was called Deja Vu.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, just a very romantic.
Our show does have, I gave a quote about one of his movies that was on the New York Times ad a couple of years ago that they used. So we actually do have ties to Henry Jekyll and with
Tana
Frederick.
With Tana Frederick, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Jeez, I have to tell you, I mean, Someone to Love just brightened my weekend so much.
Does it have the Jefferson Starship song on it? Or?
If only. No, Starship, it doesn't have that. But it does have a lot of great songs in it. Andrea Markovici, who's also a singer, who you might remember, I don't know, you'd have to be a real movie geek to remember this, but she was the female lead in Martin Ritt's movie, The Front, which starred Woody Allen.
Oh, yeah.
And she was the female lead in that, and she's kind of the female lead in this. She's the woman that Henry Jekyll is pining after, and she sings in it too. She actually sings the title song, which is not written for the movie. It was a song that she's covering, and she sings it at the piano, playing the piano. And Stephen Bishop sings some songs, and there's Dave Frischberg, who's also in it, who wrote some of the songs for Schoolhouse Rock, you know.
Oh, yeah, Schoolhouse Rock, wow.
Yeah, from the 70s, yeah. So Dave Frischberg sings a few songs, and it is a magnificent,
We'll track down that VHS, and we'll check it out. Hey.
It's probably on DVD. It deserves to be on DVD. If it's not, it's a crime.
Karen Black has been in a recent Henry Jekyll film. Which one was she in? She was in Irene in Time.
She's been in a couple of them too. She might be in Can I Bake a Cherry Pie or something like that. I think.
Anyway, so she's been in a couple of Henry Jekyll films, and we'll have our interview with Karen Black. We'll air that in a couple of weeks, and she actually talks about all these BBS movies like Five Easy Pieces and Drive, he said, and in the interview. We're going to air that in a couple weeks.
That's exciting.
This Sunday, Bobby Osteen comes back to us, our good buddy, with she always brings the gift of a master editor. And this Sunday, it'll be Chris Tellefson, who was just Oscar-nominated for Moneyball. He's also
though.
Yeah, absolutely. He's also edited, you know, The People versus Larry Flint, and one of my favorite movies, Smoke. He's got a lot of movies to his credit that are really interesting. And then Wednesday, do we got Wednesday? I don't even know. Next Wednesday. I can't get to our show page. Why can't I remember what we have next week?
Wait, let's see what we got.
Your head must be jumbled with names and interviews and things.
Yeah.
You know,
I spent the week. I spent today, actually, this afternoon, I spent editing the Friedkin interview, and we can't air it until July, but I can't wait to air it because.
I know. It's going to be exciting.
Roger Donaldson. Tony interviews Roger Donaldson for the Cocktail Blu-ray.
That's it.
Right. Roger
Donaldson. We got a good first week and a half or so of this month, of June, I mean, coming up. Hey, speaking of Kubrick, I got invited to be to do an on-camera interview on a Kubrick documentary.
Oh, cool.
Really? Wow.
Somebody called me, and they said, we've been listening to the Kubrick series religiously, and we're fascinated by the take that you didn't like him, and then you turned around on him. And so we want to do an on-camera interview. Like, can we fly to you and shoot you for our documentary? And apparently the documentary kind of culminates in Eyes Wide Shut, where Eyes Wide Shut becomes the main focus, but they cover all of his other stuff, too, as a prelude. But well, it's interesting.
That's awesome. Do it.
That's really good. You got to do it. You know, I have to tell you something. You know, when I was at the New York Film Festival this past year, I tried to I informed the publicity head of New York Film Festival, and I actually called the editor of Film Comment, and I said I talked to him personally, and I said, you know, there's a great series going on that we're doing called the Kubrick series, and I really think you guys should listen to it because it's really terrific, you know. And I think you guys should report on it, you know. And
I'm not sure that
when I go back this fall, I'm going to follow up on it, I'm hoping that they'll do an article on it because I think it deserves it's a magnificent achievement, and really it's all you, Jamie, you know, and it's a magnificent
achievement. It's all Kubrick. I couldn't do this for Daniel Petrie. Hey, but you had mentioned Film Comment, and just it flashed in my mind. I mean, Film Comment's obviously still around. But you guys remember that great magazine, American Film?
I think that was probably the best film magazine.
That was my favorite thing in the 80s. I just waited for that. I loved it.
I remember when that went bust, because I had a subscription to it. When that went bust, they said, but we're replacing the remainder of your issues with Premiere Magazine.
That's a good
point.
Well, even Premiere, though.
Better than nothing, though.
Better than nothing. Yes.
I mean, I had the entire run, practically. I mean, every issue.
It's really a shame that, you know, I mean, let's talk about film magazines for a little bit. I mean, like, where are they? I mean, all there is Film Comment, Shock Cinema.
Empire
is good. But what else is there?
Well, there's Movie Maker magazine.
Movie Maker. Okay. And of course, Cinefex. I like Cinefex because I love Cinefex because it goes into an American cinematographer too,
mm-hmm.
because they go into the technical side of things. I like reading about the technical aspects of things. But other than those,
Total
what
film.
Else is there?
Well, there
I mean,
the,
there was... Yeah.
Film Threat and American Film I always thought were the best, but...
Well,
they,
Film Threat is dead except
online,
right?
Film Threat died in the late 90s, really. Remember they tried to revitalize it? They, like, changed the format and everything, and... That was very short-lived.
I don't know what company has a profitable magazine. Anyway, I don't know. I'd be interested to find out what magazines, if any, make money in their print format.
Well, they have to make some kind of money to keep on going, you know what I'm saying?
Not necessarily.
You know?
I mean, there's a lot of them might be part of bigger conglomerates that, you know, they just accept a loss and see what they can do with it. I mean, Time is owned by Time or Warner Brothers or well, that's
Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
Which is owned by, is that still owned by AOL?
Time owns Warner Brothers, doesn't it? Or is it the opposite way around?
No, it's owned by AOL now, because I used to work for Turner, which was owned by Time Warner. And then it got swallowed up by AOL, so therefore Time is owned by AOL now.
Okay.
So.
It's owned by somebody.
Yeah, well, everything's owned by something.
Something gets the, you know, the bigger fish comes up and swallows up the smaller fish, you know.
Reviews of Prometheus are trickling in today.
Yeah, I saw that earlier. I saw.
They're not glowing necessarily. I mean, they're complimentary.
Yeah.
Particularly Michael Fassbender's performance. They say it's not the quiet menace of Alien. I think that's why they purposely wanted to kind of distance themselves from Alien and at the same time capitalize on, you know, the connection that there is there to Alien. It's a delicate balance.
Mm-hmm.
Because, it takes, like, an inspiration from Alien and makes a whole different kind of journey from it.
Right.
Apparently. I go see it tomorrow night, so I'll be able to tell you guys about it Sunday. But.
Okay.
Oh, wow, exciting. I mean, I wish, I'll tell you, that's one of the number one things that I don't care what any review has to say about it. I just want to revisit that world, and that's it.
No matter what, you know it's going to be a spectacular visual feast.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
But it's still surprised that it's not like Alien, because, you know, there's like, you know, you can look at the previews and tell that it's not like Alien. You know, you compare you compare the trailer to Prometheus to the original trailer of Alien, and it's a completely different thing. So.
It is and it isn't, though. There's obviously one similarity in the trailer for the movie that's exactly like Alien. And I mean, they spell it out for you in the trailer that it.
Well, that's the inspiration that came from Alien.
Yeah,
it's,
I
like
mean,
how do we continue this? Because Ridley Scott said the thing that surprised him most about the sequels is they never addressed that crashed spaceship and the pods and where they come from.
Yeah,
so that's the starting point, and I think they built something entirely different from that starting point.
Right.
But
right.
Charlize Theron is doing press for Snow White and Prometheus, and they asked her about Fury Road, and this started making headlines just a couple hours ago. Well, she said they're going to start shooting soon, and they said that Fury Road is a complete reboot of the Mad Max series that George Miller's doing, that Thomas Hardy does not play Mel Gibson's character Mad Max or a version of it, like a completely new character with a new set of circumstances.
Oh, interesting. That's fascinating.
Yeah, that is. We'll just have to see.
That's a good move, I think.
It's a very good move, because I don't see how else you could really do that.
Yeah. Originally, when Mel Gibson was going to play it, I think they were going to, I mean, it was a reboot, and they were going to set it in Nazi Germany. But that's like the
That's funny.
Now,
I like that.
Now, have we talked about The Great Gatsby yet?
Yeah, about the trailer.
Bit, yeah.
Well,
if you got something to add, please.
I'm just gonna like spend like 30 seconds on it, but like just I mean I looked at the preview for that this weekend, and I thought, well, I'm reading the book right now, you know, like it's the first fiction book that I've ever read before I've seen the movie. Since I think The Shining back in 1980, so I think it's going to be very weird, because it looks like they're concentrating, at least on the previews, it looks like they're concentrating a little bit too much on the parties and not enough on the drama. So,
well, I mean, the previews are 2.5 minutes of images, and I guess you want the most dynamic images in your preview.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I do understand that and everything, but anyway, I'm definitely going to be there. The thing I'm most interested about is that the score is by Craig Armstrong.
Oh.
And now Craig Armstrong is interesting because Moulin Rouge was famous for its music, but the best piece of music that came from Moulin Rouge came on in its closing credits. The closing credits music to Moulin Rouge is absolutely unbelievable. It's got two different orchestras playing in it and sort of like a rock combo underscore to it on top of it.
Yeah,
so
not busy
like,
at all.
It's ridiculous. That piece of scoring that closes Moulin Rouge is 7 minutes of some of the greatest film music I've ever heard. And for years, I tried to track down who wrote this. This is ridiculous. And it is Craig Armstrong who wrote the score with that 7 minute piece. And I'm sure he was involved with the music, the scoring of the whole movie. But
yeah.
But the fact that he does the entire score for Great Gatsby makes me incredibly excited for that movie. I think that movie is going to be like just mind blowing.
I hope it is.
If they do it right, I think it's going to be mind blowing.
We got some other movie news I want to mention, but first of all, Joseph Eisenberg wrote us. He wanted to throw in a title that we might have missed in our war conversation. The Japanese masterpiece Fire on the Plains.
Oh, that's a good one.
Well, there were a lot of like we didn't go to a lot of different countries, you know. I mean, we could have done a whole show on Japanese war movies. I mean, we could have done Ron
Kurosawa,
and Throne of Blood
yeah.
and so many other.
Yeah,
things,
there's a lot.
Know.
I mean, there's Fires on the Plains. I mean, yeah, that's a good one. I mean, there's a lot of great ones. I mean,
I really want to do a show on Kurosawa. I really want to do like a film masters series of shows at our leisure,
mm-hmm.
where we can kind of look into filmmakers that I personally don't know as much about as I'd like.
Right,
Truffaut, and you know, I've seen most Kurosawa movies. So, but do a show on Kurosawa and Billy Wilder and all those people.
Mm-hmm.
Like
that'd be good.
My two things I would want to throw in there: Cassavetes,
mm-hmm.
and of course my favorite filmmaker. That's living today, at least, Mike Lee.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm all for Cassavetes. I was thinking of doing only dead people.
Only dead people. Okay.
Yeah, and actually, have that be the title of the series.
Dead directors.
Yes.
Dead directors.
Anyway, here's some other movie news. Did you guys watch Hatfield and McCoys?
No.
It's a huge hit, right?
Enormous hit. I mean,
yeah, I haven't seen any
like
of it.
It was almost 14 million people who watched
that's
on the History Channel.
But no, I mean, that's incredible. Cause everyone gets the History Channel, though, so that's an incredible. But that's an incredible feat, though. That's a great.
That's
an awesome number.
Is that better? I think that's better than anything that The Sopranos ever did.
Oh, yeah. Remember.
Well, it's the highest rated basic cable mm-hmm. program that's not sports related
yeah.
in history.
I mean, because you got to remember, a lot of people, you know, as much as it, like The Sopranos and like True Blood is popular and all that, you know, a lot of people don't have the premium channels.
Yeah,
that's something you always get. I had to even, you know, a while ago, had to really keep that in check because you would think, oh, everyone, no, not every, a lot of people don't have these. I guess because obviously everyone has the History Channel or everyone has the basic cable channel, and yeah, I mean it's a big, big hit.
Well, it's especially a good victory for them too because. This isn't their first foray into a made-for-History Channel movie. Their first foray into it was kind of a disaster because they were the ones that financed the Kennedys.
Oh,
and then they backed out of it.
Oh, right. But didn't they just pick that up though? They didn't really.
No,
didn't
I think
they just
they,
pick
they,
it
no,
up.
It was. Well, I don't know. I don't know if they financed it from the very beginning. But as they're shooting it, it was known that they're shooting it for the History Channel.
Mm, okay.
So they're in on it very early. And then
the
I think
Kennedys
they watched
actually,
it. And they,
but the Kennedys actually came up and actually got some. I mean, I know it did well at the Emmys and at the Golden Globes and everything. So it actually, that the Kennedys actually came up and actually got some respect, you know, even though it was controversial when it first, you know, was.
Yeah,
first
I mean, watching it, I didn't find anything particularly controversial, but I thought, what's the big deal? But I guess it wasn't historical enough. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of conjecture when you go into Kennedy and his women and all of that kind of, the back medication
right.
and all that kind of stuff. It's sensitive.
Well, I think that was the thing, was that it was the first, it was, I mean, there have been tons and tons of TV projects that have, and movie projects that have tackled the Kennedys, but that was the first one that actually tackled the promiscuity of the president and his brother at the time. So,
yeah, well, to that extent, yeah. They came out with a reason, some reasons why they pushed back G.I. Joe.
They went more Channing Tatum, you know?
More Tatum.
More Channing Tatum. They want to have more Channing Tatum movies before they put it out.
Apparently he died or something in it, so they
He died,
back.
Like, I think in the first 5 minutes of the movie.
He does?
Yeah, I mean, because you remember in the trailer, if you've seen the trailer, they basically, it's like The Rock and two other people are all that's left of the team.
I'm not going to watch the trailer of the G.I. Joe movie. That thing is a dead fish in the water. I mean, why
here's,
the hell
okay.
would they make that?
Preview audiences at the first screening of the film thought it was good, but with two big concerns. They didn't like the fact that Channing Tatum and The Rock really didn't have any time to develop a friendship before Channing died.
How are they going to go back and fix that, though? That's what I want to know.
And they also had a problem
Maybe
with
that's
why
they pushed it back. Maybe they're going to go and
well,
do some reshoot.
That's what I'm saying. That's why they're pushing it back.
Yeah.
And they said, why wasn't it in 3D?
Why would you want... All right, I don't know. I mean,
okay, well, that's what you get from... That's what you get from preview audiences. That's what you get from...
They've
from
dropped the Kool-Aid.
Yeah. Exactly.
Hmm. Well, I wouldn't watch a G.I. Joe movie anyway. But, I mean, I hope they're successful.
What was the preview that you that came out today that you were talking about?
The preview that came out today was a minute and 30-second teaser for Les Miserables.
I think it looks wonderful.
Oh, yes.
I saw
a little bit about that.
Yeah.
Did it? Really? Yeah.
It gave me chills.
Yeah, I thought she did a great job singing that song. I mean, I thought that was incredible. I mean,
it's Tom Hopper's Hooper Hopper?
Hooper.
It's his follow-up to The King's Speech, so, I mean, it's got Oscar written all over it.
Right.
But Hugh Jackman, Russell Crowe, Anne Hathaway, it is a full-fledged musical version, but
mm-hmm.
what's different about the way he shoots it, this is my understanding of it, is all the singing is live on camera.
Oh, that's very exciting.
Yeah, no, that was really good. I mean,
he's not the first guy to do that, but man, that means that he's really committed to it. And from what I've understood from his interviews, he really is really deeply committed to this. To this movie, it's something that he really believes in. So, you know, there's a lot of people that slam The King's Speech, after its Oscar win and everything,
mm-hmm.
Especially after it won over The Social Network. But you know what? He's a great director. I mean, I knew he was a great director back when he did John Adams for HBO. I mean, John Adams was a magnificent achievement, and so was The King's Speech. The King's Speech was a very, very great movie. Maybe not as great as The Social Network,
It's still a good movie. It's still a good movie. I like it.
It's still very good, and it's very well directed. I mean, very unusually directed. His camera placements and everything are very, very distinct, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too. I like The King's Speech a lot. I didn't actually see it until months after it came out on DVD, like months after it was given Best Picture. And I thought, okay, well, I'm not so upset about that now. That's good.
Yeah. he's good.
Here's the trailer to Les Miserables. Just imagine gorgeous, sweeping imagery accompanying Anne Hathaway's singing.
Oh, neat.
I dreamed a dream in time gone by, and hope was high, life worth living. I dreamed that love would never die. I dreamed that God would be forgiving. That night, the dead voices swooshed asunder. I had a dream my life would be so different from this hell I'm living, so different now from what it seems.
People had doubts that Anne Hathaway could sing the part, even though, you know, she obviously can't.
She obviously has that in her background. I don't know about, I can understand maybe to an extent Catwoman to an extent, but why this? She has,
I agree with you, Jerry. Why are people shitting on Anne Hathaway? She's awesome.
But
she's
for this, I
great.
Mean, she's a natural for this. I mean.
Yeah. I mean, for years, you know, I think you all can agree with me. For years, I've been wishing for a musical with major stars who we know can sing, and this is it. Jacqueline, Crow, and Hathaway. We know all three of them can sing and sing very well. There's not going to be any kind of dubbing. This is them singing.
Yeah.
And I love that Hooper has decided to, has even underlined it by just saying, listen, this is all going to be live singing. So there you go. You know, I think this is going to be an amazing movie. I've never listened to or watched the musical Les Miserables. But I'm glad that I've waited because I was waiting for years for the movie version to come out, and it seems like they're going to do it right.
Yeah,
so.
Well, it's a great musical. God, we saw this in 1987, but I just don't understand. I could understand, like I said, to an extent, and then when you see the trailer for The Dark Knight Rises, I have no doubts about Anne Hathaway. I mean, it's the least of my worries with the movie. I don't even know why I should even say I'm worried about the movie. The only thing I'm worried about is
I had doubts about was including Catwoman in the first place.
Yeah, but I understand why they did, because if my memory serves me correct, they're still basing like The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises off the long Halloween storyline, which Catwoman is actually in, so I can understand them including her. But going back, Anne Hathaway is a natural for this because she does have a background in singing and this kind of performance, so I don't see why there would be
doubt. I think the people that complained about it had no idea that she has a background in that.
I think you're right.
I mean, I think it's the same thing. Like, remember a couple of weeks ago, Jamie, you brought up the people, the post that said people were crapping on
what do you do? Are you bowling? What are you doing?
Well, no, they were crapping.
Put the phone on your
on
to your mouth.
On, well, I'm sorry. They were talking about how they hated the fact that Heath Ledger was cast as the, you know, it's the same thing. You know, it's like you don't know what you're talking about. You know, stop talking about things before you see them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, give the director who's doing the project, give the studio that's giving $100 million towards it the benefit of the doubt that they think that they chose right.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. Exactly.
Do you get the sense, Jerry, that Dean never gets to really talk about this stuff, so he stores it all within himself, and it just all, like, blows up?
You're absolutely right. I have absolutely nobody to talk to like I do you guys. I look forward to this every week. I want as many shows to come out as possible because, really, seriously, I have nobody. I mean, I'm in Atlanta, for God's sake. I have
I'm
absolutely
in Atlanta,
nobody.
For God's sake. This should be the tagline.
I'm in Atlanta, for God's sake. There's nobody here who knows anything about movies, even though this is Atlanta is like a huge hub of movie production.
I wish I had some sad music to play over your therapeutic confession here, Dean, but the best I could do is this. Continue on.
Okay. Yeah. I can't talk to anybody about movies here. So I love talking about movies here, you know?
I mean,
it's just like, yeah. Anyway.
Well, we're your movie family.
Yes, you are.
Hey, we came out with some new clips of a new clip of William Friedkin. I posted a little clip of him talking about Stanley Kubrick earlier today. People are like rabid for this William Friedkin. Like, people are leaving comments on YouTube and emails and stuff. So
neat,
it's coming. And actually, like, it's a good 20 minutes of the interview, we talk about the film culture. I realized, like, look, we talked for that long, like an hour and 15 or so minutes, and we talk about very few of his movies, actually.
Really?
Yeah. It's like we talk about The Exorcist, we mention Rampage, and talk a little bit about Killer Joe, and Sorcerer.
And Sorcerer, of course.
Yeah. Outside of that, we talk about film culture, we talk about other filmmakers, we talk about technology, and it's interesting.
Boy, it sounds like a great interview.
Yeah.
It just went wherever it went. And, you know,
right.
I don't write – I think I've said this before. I don't write anything down when I do an interview.
Mm-hmm.
So I just make sure that, you know, I see some interviews with them previously that are on YouTube or something that kind of feel inspired or whatever. And then I just go into the interview, and I usually know what my first question will be.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's it. And sometimes that's dangerous. If the guest is a dud, I mean, I'll be stammering from here to eternity. But if the guest is not a dud and he's articulate, like William Friedkin, it's a real kind of conversation.
Right.
And Friedkin is, of all things, if anything, he is one of the most articulate filmmakers I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a great interview. Okay. Patrick Reed Johnson also coming up soon on the show. Okay.
You
anything
know,
else?
Do you have a movie?
Wait. Prometheus tomorrow night, right? You're going to
right.
see the, you know what you're going to see a trailer for in front of that.
You know, in these press screenings, they rarely put trailers on it.
They don't put trailers
on
it.
Oh, okay.
They're
supposed to have Django Unchained. It's supposed to have a teaser. It's supposed to be a
trailer. They might put it on there, though,
they
for
might,
you. Because
for you,
baby, a,
they might do
a,
that for you.
They might do that.
I
you
think
know?
So. I'd love
yeah.
to see it.
Do you have a movie list tonight? Because I have one. It's short, too.
Oh, my God. This is becoming so ritualistic.
I thought there was something else I need to bring up first. Anyway, yeah. Django Unchained. Yeah, there are new photos of Django Unchained. They're on our Twitter page. Also on our Twitter page, twitter.com/moviegeeksunite. Follow us because we put great stuff on there. There's a 70-minute audio lecture/interview with Charlie Kaufman. And I listened to the whole thing. It's great. It's fantastic.
Cool.
Okay, Dean, wow. What's the topic of your
what's
list?
What's the top of the list?
Okay, well, this list, and next time we come on, I'm going to have a list of my own creation. But this time I'm getting the list from the great book from the Onions AV Club called The Inventory.
Mm-hmm.
Have you guys gotten that book yet? It's a great book of lists. If you've never looked at it,
look, I'm really scared what this list is going to be. But let's get to it.
And this is a very short list, so you know it's very funny too. But the inventory is a terrific book of lists, mostly about music and movies and a little bit else about pop culture.
Okay.
So what's the list?
The list is a guest list done by the book, done for the book version by Robert Ben Garant. And Robert Ben Garant is the founding member of the State and the Reno 911.
Okay,
He plays the guy who comes on who has the shorts on all the time in Reno 911.
Okay,
He directed the Reno 911 movie and Balls of Fury. And these are his nine moments in movies I had to turn away from.
Okay.
So we're going to start with number nine, and I'm reading them just like they're written. When Gage cuts Fred Gwynn's ankle tendons in Pet
uh-huh.
Cemetery.
Uh-huh. That was painful in the book. That was painful in the book too.
Yeah. I mean,
you know,
it's
odd how you can have like dismemberment and all the most grotesque stuff in a movie or book, but it's like the practical stuff that really gets you. Like even with The Exorcist, Friedkin was saying the part that freaked people out most in that movie was
the spinal tap version? Was the spinal tap?
Yeah, when they put the thing in her neck and they release in the blood spurts. I forget what that's called.
Yeah. It's a spinal. That's her getting a real spinal tap. That's what a real spinal tap is.
Now, the original title of that film was "This is Spinal Tap."
Okay,
go ahead. Number eight.
Number eight is the entire movie of the entire. In the list, it just says Freaks.
Mm.
Which means the entire movie.
Uh-huh.
Todd Browning's
okay, I can
movie,
see that.
Freak.
Okay.
Yeah, which is a tough movie. If you're not prepared for Freaks, you have to get prepared for that. Because really, has there ever been a movie made like Freaks? No.
Anyone else reborn as Todd Browning? No.
My home movie's coming close. So that's what I mean.
By the way, do you know I have a good friend? With this Freaks thing, I wasn't planning this, do you know I have a good friend who is related to one of the pinheads in Freaks?
Wow!
Oh my God! I know.
That doesn't surprise me.
Why doesn't it surprise me?
I have a good friend, and he's married, and he and his wife say that they don't want to have children because they're afraid that they're going to have a pinhead.
Oh, wow. My God. Okay. I don't believe it. Between this and the Christopher Lee paintings, I don't know.
Does he have his own collection of Christopher Lee paintings as well? Go ahead. Number seven.
When the guy eats the boar testicles in Apocalypto.
Okay.
I don't. You know what? That's funny. I don't even remember that scene. But okay.
It's in the first 20 minutes of the movie because it's like a rite of passage.
What was the direction there? Pretend it's your ex-wife. Hey, you know what? What about that zombie? That guy eating the other guy's head on the side of the road.
Yeah, in your home state. I mean,
man. all I was thinking of tonight, I mean, a cop came up to this naked guy. He was eating the face of this other guy on the middle, in the middle of the road.
Mm-hmm.
All I was thinking is, what must have been like for that cop? Because that kind of shit is not in the manual. It's not like question 217.
Wait a minute. This actually happened in Florida?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, dude, it's been all over the place. I mean...
I'm staying away from the internet for a month or maybe 2 months. So, really, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
It was something crazy. All the crazy stuff has to happen in Florida.
Well, I'm telling you the zombie craziness, because people are like, you know, there's like people like giving lectures on how to survive a zombie apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
Zombies don't exist, people. They don't exist. It's just an imaginary thing. They don't exist, you know.
I appreciate you clearing that up.
Thank you. I had no idea.
People are crazy, though. They're like people want a zombie apocalypse to happen. You know why?
Well, the one thing
because
that does exist is crazy.
I'm proof of that. Okay, so here's number six. When the baby, and I'm reading this exactly as it's written. Number six, when the baby in Eraserhead gets, quote unquote, sick, and when the girl in the radiator steps on the ... things she steps on,
mm-hmm.
actually most of Eraserhead.
Okay, I could see that. I mean,
that's number six. Number five, when the guy shaves his head clean and clean shaven.
Ooh, yeah. Mm. That's the Peter Green movie, right?
It's Lodge Kerrigan from Canada. Lodge Kerrigan.
Yeah, but I mean, Peter Green's in it, isn't he? Like actor.
Yeah, he's the star. Right.
Yeah.
Right. You're right. Yeah.
What's
number
about
four?
That? He shaves his head.
It's just very rough how he does it, you know, in that
movie. Bleeding and stuff.
Yeah, it's just very. You just gotta watch it.
That's like Scorsese's short film, The Big Shave.
Yeah, exactly. It's got a lot to do with that. Yeah. Number four. When the medic has to find the Marine's vein in his leg in Black Hawk Down.
Okay. Yeah. I mean.
That's rough.
I can see that. It almost seems kind of tame compared to some of the other stuff in this list, but okay.
Well, I mean, it's really rough in the movie because it comes at a time where you're actually exhausted. You know,
that's
you're,
true. Yeah, you're right. I mean, you're
absolutely
right.
You know what
right.
I mean? You're fucking exhausted, and it's nighttime, and you think, oh, everything's going to be okay when it's night, and then they got this to deal with. Number three, when Kathy Bates, quote unquote, hobbled James Caan in Misery.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Number two, when the girl in Audition cut off the dude's feet.
Mm.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
man, this guy has a foot fetish. Like, every other thing is about feet.
For me in Audition, the thing that really makes me, like, cringe is the needles in the eye.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah. I mean,
you know, they...
I don't like the vomit thing. I can't get down with that.
Audition is a scary movie, though.
Oh, it's very scary.
And then number one, and I think we can all agree, you know, maybe not the thing that we would all turn away from, but this is a horrible moment. When the fly barfs acid onto Gina Davis's boss's ankle in The Fly.
I don't feel the need to look away at that. I think that's so cool. You know what's missing from this list? And if I bring this up to a lot of people, I know they'll say the same thing, is the scene in American History X with his teeth on the sidewalk, on the curb.
Oh, and he curbs them, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a,
yeah.
That's a, just a, yeah, oh, yeah.
That should be in here to make it an even 10, you know, because it's only 9. That should be on here.
Yeah, that's what's so disturbing to me about 10. This list. It's not an even 10. That's what made me look
away. Made you
well,
turn
away. Well, yeah, there's tonight's list.
All right, wow.
Awesome. We'll be back Sunday night with more Therapy with Dean. And our guest, Chris Tellefson, Academy Award-nominated editor. go to us on Facebook, facebook.com/moviegeeksunited, twitter.com/moviegeeksunite. Subscribe to us via YouTube for great archive material, and you'll get new interviews before they're aired on the show at times, too, at youtube.com/moviegeeksunited. Moviegeeksunited.net is our website. I think that just about covers it.
Yep.
I'm exhausted after that.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
All right.
Have a good weekend. Thank you, man. I'll post my review.
Okay, cool.
All right. Good. I hope you enjoy it. Talk to you later.
All right. Good night,
good night,
everyone.
Guys.
Bye.
Bye.